Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Brainwaves, hear the world differently. Bringing community mental health to you, raising awareness and challenging stigma. Tune in to 3CR Community Radio, Wednesdays at 5pm.
Melbourne's Drive Time Radio program, featuring community organisations, powerful stories and information. Find us at brainwaves.org.au. Proudly sponsored by Wellways Australia.
I would like to begin by paying my respects to the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which I am coming to you from today. Land where at Brainwaves we tell our stories, and land where the traditional custodians have told their stories for many, many years before us, and continue to tell their stories. I would like to pay my respects to elders past and present, and acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners who are listening today.
Hello and welcome to Brainwaves on 3CR, 8:55am, 3CR Digital Radio and 3cr.org.au. My name's Mark and today we're chatting to Rosie Roulette, the director of Pokalesque, a choose-your-own-adventure-style parody of Pokemon, which will be held in late February. We'll be chatting about Pokalesque and as well as mental health and disability in the performing arts. So, yeah, thank you for joining us today, Rosie. How are you going?
Hi, I'm good. Thank you very much for having me.
So for any of our listeners who aren't aware of your work, would you like to introduce yourself?
Absolutely. So hi, I'm Rosie Roulette. I'm a Kiwi-born artist who jumped ship in 2014 over here to Australia. And I have several disabilities and I'm also autistic and ADHD. So a lot of what I've decided to do with my work is very disability focused, accessibility focused, and having had challenges myself with doing the professional circuit of work, I've dived into producing my own so that I can set my own rules and limitations.
How long have you been a part of the burlesque scene for?
Yeah, so I do burlesque, drag, and all kinds of cabaret-related performance. Burlesque I have been doing since, let's say, like 2015 properly, but I had dived into it sort of dabbling before that.
And you've got an upcoming show starting later in February called Pokalesque. Can you tell us a bit about the show?
Absolutely. So this is a show that really is a fusion of theatre and burlesque, as well as drag and other performance as well. So I, as a writer, have written a script. It's all very much a parody of Pokemon and many other pop culture things under the banner of Geek Out Nerdlesque, which is a company that I run here in Melbourne. So the show is, as you said, a choose-your-own-adventure style parody. So the audience does get to actually play an active role in certain decisions that the protagonist and other characters have. So for example, you get to choose their names from the beginning of the show, very much like you would in the original games. And you get to follow your protagonists along on their journey whilst they discover many pocket monsters in along the way, which happen to be our burlesque performance.
So the show actually brings together burlesque performers and drag artists. How did such a diverse group of performers find one another in the first place?
I love that question. Well, having had a background myself in musical theatre, so I probably should have mentioned before that my bachelor is in musical theatre and performing arts. So that's what I studied before I moved over here from New Zealand. I have a very extensive background in musical theatre and opera and all sorts, and I've sort of brought that into the burlesque world as I know it. And doing so, I have met all kinds of people, and of course, you look at drag, and a lot of us are theatre kids. So many of us are theatre kids and or neurodivergent. So I've sort of been accumulating all kinds of artists that I want to support and platform with disability and related interests over the last 10 years. And then I held auditions for our actors. So the core cast, let's call them the Elite Four, our Elite Four main actors who drive the story narrative of the show. I auditioned, and I've sort of brought them into this world of burlesque and drag and sort of mixed everyone up into this beautiful pie.
Do you want to tell us a bit about the other performers, who they are, and how what role they play in the show?
Absolutely. So we've got Lucy May Knight, who is our protagonist. She plays the trainer. The trainer is obviously the person we follow on their journey, and she is absolutely incredible as an actor and performer. Adam White is the rival, and he is also named by the audience. He's an incredible actor as well, who obviously provides the antagonistic part of the story. And these two work incredibly together, so they're very, very funny. We've also got Darren Kessler, who is playing the Pokemon Professor, Professor Wood, and a couple of other characters. And we've got Cy Quinn playing the mother and many other characters as well. So these are the main four actors who you get to follow on their journey. They're all incredibly funny, and they bring their own improv elements into the show and into the script that I've written. So no two shows are truly the same.
As I understand, the cast all share a love of Pokemon, obviously,
mm-hmm.
but many of you also navigate life as neurodivergent individuals, and that's right, isn't it? That's sort of what brought you all together as well. So what does being neurodivergent mean to you personally?
Well, I'm a late diagnosed autistic ADHD, so I only got my formal diagnosis when I was, let's say, yes, about 4 years ago now. And I had no idea going forward for like the first 28 years of my life that this was my story. And it was very eye-opening for me. It was a friend of mine who studies psychology and is autistic themselves who sort of really put me on the path to getting an ADHD diagnosis first. And it's sort of really shaped the way that I not only perceive myself, but perceive everybody else around me and how I work. Having sort of hyperfixated on ADHD and autism in the last few years since my diagnosis, obviously I do now view it very much as just a sort of a neurodifference. And there's quite a few of us out there, and obviously more diagnoses are happening with more information now accessible. So I find that I'm able to kind of very quickly tune in to whether or not people are displaying traits of ADHD and or autism or other neurodivergence. And I, in my practices, make sure that those are very much accommodated for.
How does neurodivergence shape or influence Pokalesque as a production?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say everybody in the cast is neurodivergent, diagnosed or otherwise, or at least, you know, are displaying some of them, I think, are displaying very much that they are our kin. And so Rehearsals are usually quite relaxed. We will have a framework of what we're working around, but we will take regular breaks, and I will also very much be on guard watching for anything that needs to be accommodated. It's a very sort of safe space, and I think we've garnered an environment of trust. So my actors do tend to talk to me beforehand if they're having a bad brain day, if something's sort of making it challenging for them, and I will always talk with them before rehearsal one-on-one about what's going to be best for them.
Yeah, that kind of answers my question. I was going to ask, how do performers communicate those needs and do they feel comfortable to speak up? So it sounds like you've really created an environment where that is just a norm.
That's really important to me. It's really important to me that whilst we're working on anything, that we see each other as human first. And a huge part of the human experience is different brain types and neurodivergence. And being such a neurodivergent team, we are all on different parts of the spectrum, but parts of the spectrum that work very well together. And we're all very sort of, we give each other a lot of lenience whilst also being able to prioritize the work.
More broadly, what do accommodations look like in the performing arts, and what types of adjustments might an autistic, disabled, or ADHD performer request in order to fully participate?
Of course. Yes, so obviously with autism and sometimes with ADHD as well, a lot of these can be very overwhelming. I applaud a lot of people who are able to sort of just tough it through all of the blinding lights and everything that kind of goes into theatre. But of course, when it comes to the actual performances, I always make sure that there is obviously a quiet place so that when they're not on stage, if they are pretty overwhelmed on any particular day, we have a space where they can go and just chill out and obviously get their overwhelm and their overstimulation sort of under control. I also do offer sort of slightly more relaxed performances so that we're not going like crazy on lighting. I do have a sort of system for what is and isn't allowed with our lighting techs. So very sort of simple things would include zero strobing effects ever at any of our events, anything that's going to be like a potential trigger for epilepsy or like very overwhelming for the senses, I just straight out won't use that in our lighting plots. And similarly, I'll also just kind of encourage an environment where it is sort of a bit more relaxed. Obviously, with the audience being able to participate and the back and forward, it doesn't really feel as rigid and serious. There isn't a very clear fourth wall with the shows that I produce, even when they're more storylined. So it does kind of feel like you're more sort of chilling out with friends. In a way, more than high stakes, rigid performance, if that makes sense. And I feel like the people, at least, that I work with actually vibe very well with that.
Yeah, I'd imagine that. I would imagine that it would be very quite simple or simpler to create that sort of atmosphere, since the types of people that will be coming to see the performance are also Pokemon fans. So it's easier to
Absolutely.
keep that sort of mutuality. Everyone loves this
And I won't,
subculture, yeah. So yeah.
I won't deny that Pokemon is probably my autistic special interest, and it's a very common autistic special interest. So I would not be surprised if a lot of our main audience are fellow neurospicy folk.
Can you give an example of how neurodivergence can sometimes create challenges in this space?
Yes, absolutely. So obviously kind of going back onto the autistic overstimulation and overwhelm, lighting and obviously sound is a big one. So that's why I do try my best to design our lighting plots to be pretty simple and open and to just hard ban any sort of very clearly triggering types of lighting. Other challenges obviously include just obviously very noisy stuff. So I do tend to kind of have like a very low volume on certain things. So for example, we have a quote unquote club scene where we go to the Pink Ponyta, which is obviously a play on the Ponyta Pokemon and the Pink Pony Club from Chapelron. We have whilst wanting to create the environment of the club, but without it being like the actual environment of a club, we have the settings for the club music at a very sort of specific setting so that it's not one overpowering the dialogue, but two not overpowering anybody's ears. So we try to simulate it in a more sort of in a more calm way, if that makes any sense. Because there are things that we want to include whilst also not making them inaccessible for those who obviously want to be involved and be there.
I guess on the other hand, where can neurodivergence be a real advantage when it comes to performance?
Hell yeah. I mean, we tend to be very passionate and creative people. So, even though the discussions at rehearsals can get like a little out of control, it's always fun and it always tends to accumulate in some incredible offers from the cast. And I create an environment where offers from the cast for if they want to like put in a joke or something, they always have a creative input. And these people are all incredibly creative. So not just the main acting cast, but obviously all of the drag and burlesque artists themselves. I give them full creative control over what they are allowed to create their acts to be. I'm not dictating that or directing that. We just kind of sign off on it to make sure that it kind of fits within the world. But the creativity, obviously, and the passion is very much a strength within our community. And you see it in just buckets and buckets. And I just love it so much. We get so passionately involved in this project, and everybody's bringing such incredible ideas, and that's what I think I love the most about this show.
So Pokalesque is a choose your own adventure. How does that work? How does the audience participate in shaping the show?
Yeah, so we touched on it very quickly, but the first indication of that happens straight off the bat. So, any lovers of the original Pokemon games will be very familiar with the opening of the Pokemon professor asking, "Are you a boy or are you a girl?" So, we name and allow the audience to pick the gender of our protagonist, and there'll be slight changes depending on, whether you designate them as a girl, a boy, non-binary, or anything. And we also have a lot of fun throughout the script for when their names are come up based, and they will obviously be whatever you have designated. So most people who have played the games will know that we usually name the rivals something stupid because we hate them because they're mean and they're a rival. So, for example, you might have Ass Face as our sort of like stand-in example, and there's lots of opportunities in the script for our chosen audience name to shine. We also get to choose their companion Pokemon, and that dictates what costumes you get to see as their starter Pokemon partner and companion. We also get some other sort of choices throughout the run that dictates which gyms you see and which sort of aesthetics kind of come into play. And there's a few other things that I don't want to spoil, but those are some of the examples I'm willing to give away.
It sounds kind of terrifying. The fact that the show is different every time. How does the cast manage the anxiety of having to change the show
Anxiety.
all the time, you know?
Well, yeah, I'm sure that there is anxiety around that, but it is very much within a very like some it's always in the same sort of format, and the script largely stays the same. The changes are things that are very sort of manageable, and like the names, and because of the environment of improv and the actors being pretty good with improv, if a name is forgotten, there is full rein for that actor to just fully acknowledge it and ask for it again. Like there's full permission for the cast to lean on the audience and to lean on each other. So even though things do change each performance, because there's that environment of trust and play with all of the main actors, the main characters, they're able to really work that to help each other out, and they're really good at that at this point. So they've got a lot of practice at working with each other and playing, and I think they have any anxiety with forgetting names or prompts from the audience has since ceased.
Just to go back to talking about neurodivergence, at what point in your life did you begin to suspect that you might be autistic or have ADHD?
So as I said before, I have no idea growing up. I just thought I was a weird kid. I just thought that, tales all the time. The more I've learnt, Mark, the more I've realised that I am a stereotype. And we're all the flippin' same. We fit into different categories, and it just all aligns. So I grew up having no idea. I was very much socially awkward. I was diagnosed straight off the bat with just clinical depression and anxiety. So growing up femme, I was just sort of blanket diagnosed with having anxiety and panic attacks and all of that. I look back on it now and I realize a lot of my quote unquote panic attacks were autistic meltdowns. Because one of the characteristic markers of my quote unquote panic attacks was going nonverbal. And that was never really addressed. So I obviously didn't really have clued in medical team around me. I also have grown up with very hypermobile joints. I have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. And if you know anything about common comorbidities, people with ADHD and we suspect autism as well tend to cross over with hypermobile type disorders. So I have pretty much all of the, comorbid things. And even though it took me 20 years to get the EDS diagnosis, we knew since I was like 5 years old and my knee started dislocating that there was something wrong with my joints. I've had many, many, many surgeries to try and correct dislocating joints, but incorrectly because we weren't looking at the underlying issue of the tissue being an issue. The tissue is the issue. So we went another like 9 years after I got my EDS diagnosis at 1920 before a friend of mine started telling me that I was clearly self-medicating with energy drinks because I really struggled to focus my entire life. And I can see you laughing because you can clearly relate. I've obviously tried to cope with my lack of energy and focus and things that have clearly contributed to my lack of dopamine by self-medicating, typically with Blue V, because Blue V is my favorite and I only like that one. And after they told me more about that, I was actually trying to get a partner at the time, sort of to seek diagnosis, but they, in very ADHD fashion, kept avoiding it until I somehow ended up getting an appointment instead. I don't even remember how that happened. And I ended up talking to a doctor who specializes in femme and female ADHD. And she could tell straight off the bat that that was clearly my brain and my story. And obviously, then we started talking about autism as well with the psychologist or psych. Oh my God.
One of them.
Psychiatrist who does meds, psychologist who does just brain. You can keep this in because it's so obviously ADHD coded. But to clarify and to wrap it up, I had no idea until somebody really put me on the right path, and it really opened my eyes in the last 4 years how clearly all of those parts fit. And it took me a while to get my parents to come around. And I come from a very theatrical family. My mother being my singing teacher and everything from a young age, she in very characteristic fashion didn't want to, feel like she'd missed something so clear. So she was so against the idea before I actually got the diagnosis. She's like, no, you couldn't have ADHD. You couldn't be autistic. Blah, we would have known. Nah, blah. Your brother had that, and he had all of these clear characteristics. And obviously, boy ADHD, 20 or plus years ago, I think 30 years ago, obviously a different time. And she's since come around in her own sort of way. She's done a lot of research, and she's actually now teaching a lot of kids who have ADHD and or autism. And she's now realizing and seeing all of the same characteristics that she saw in me growing up, and she's identifying them. And she's very empathetic, so she's actually usually given a lot of these kids because she works well with them. And I wouldn't be surprised if she's also undiagnosed on the spectrum somewhere herself.
What skills and strategies have you learned that have helped you navigate life with or DHD?
Or DHD. Yeah, I wish there was a better term for it,
Yeah, me too. We can invent one now if you want.
we should have been autism and ADHD. Social dopamine
Let's go with that. If any writers of the DSM-V manual are listening, feel free to use that
dysregulation
in the
disorder.
next volume.
Or SDDD. No, I'm sure somebody could come up with something better. I leave the improv to my improvisers, my actors. You're going to have to repeat the question for me, please.
Yes, so the question was, what skills and strategies have you learned to help navigate life since your diagnosis?
Yes. I've deep dived into looking up all of the research I can on autism and ADHD. I think with ADHD, it's the body doubling and a lot of those sort of tricks to try and override the brain's resistance to the get up and go, the executive dysfunction, the inability to just kickstart the task that needs to be done. Body doubling is very, very, very helpful. So I have a lot of friends who are also ADHD and or autistic, and we kind of all get that now. We've all talked about that. So I will organize times where like a friend just comes over and we just get stuff done and they're just here. And if they can't be there in person, sometimes just having them on the phone or over like a video call, you just chat, you body double virtually. Because I do struggle with getting a lot of just basic stuff done. Even with Pokalesque, I'm struggling sometimes as the writer director, and having like a team around me. So my mentee Heather and T, my main team. Did I say main T?
Yeah, but I think our listeners know what you
You
meant.
can't spell team without T,
Exactly.
and T is one of my main friends in the team. So with her and Heather, we are like a dream team of just being able to see where each other is at the day, on any given day. Am I really low spoons? Yes. Then Heather with more spoons picks up that slack or any version of that. Like I really struggle to just sort of pick up the phone sometimes, and so Heather's been helping me with like organizing this interview and everything.
Thank you, Heather.
Thank you, Heather. And all of the all of the dysregulation, it's crazy. With autism, like I'm trying to learn not to just power through. I've really struggled my whole life with just being a chronic people pleaser, so I really didn't want to let what was affecting me affect everyone else. Also, you know, you grow up without a reason for why you are this way. You are viewed a lot as a person who's just causing problems and being dramatic. I think one of my first nicknames from a very young age was Drama Queen. So, I mean, it kind of worked being in drama and the dramatic arts, but it was mainly because I was very highly emotional and didn't know how to regulate my emotions. So, coming back and having the language now, and the reasons, I'm very liberal now with just saying, hey, I am struggling with feeling my feelings really strongly right now because of my autism and or ADHD. I'm going to need to step away so that I can feel it and regulate it for a bit, because otherwise I'm going to be the problem. It's me. Hello, I'm the problem. It's me. So I will just very sort of almost matter-of-factly tell people what's happening. And now that I know what it is, I don't feel shame anymore. And I feel like once I've told somebody very directly, if they don't understand, it's now on them. The ball's in their court. I've told them very, very clearly in no short terms what's happening, that I need to step away because I'm having some reaction in my brain that I can't control, that I want to go and get under control, so that we can continue whatever is happening. If they don't understand that, they need to go do some research because I can't educate everyone. But I do try my best.
I think you went into this a little bit earlier in the interview, but what's your personal relationship with Pokemon and how long have you been a fan?
Forever. Yeah, I love Pokemon very, 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 very much. Whilst probably my first obsession was Harry Potter, that's problematic now. Funnily enough, that was the first burlesque and theatre fusion play that I wrote, was Fantastic Breasts and Where to Find Them. And that did well in 2019 as part of Melbourne Fringe. But we have retired that now in favour of Pokemon, which is much less problematic for the queer community. And given that there's a huge crossover with neurodivergence and queerness, whether or not, sexuality or genderqueer, etc., we are a very, very queer cast as well as disabled and dysregulated. So Pokemon is what I'm very happy to be making work around now. I've been obsessed since a young age. I wasn't allowed consoles as a child. I know my parents didn't really understand them, so it was kind of a like a it was a weird area. But I grew up in New Zealand on a New Zealand kids TV show. I know. So this was my first experience with Pokemon, was as a kid dressed as I maybe sometimes I was dressed up as a clown or a kiwi bird or a ballerina pig. This kids program I was on was all about dress ups. And on set, if we were good, we would be given the opportunity to choose a toy from this box of toys to take home with us. And one of them was a Game Boy, which had the original Pokemon on it. And I was obsessulated. So I grabbed that as I think my prize for being the goodest bean on set that day. Keep in mind, this was when I was, I filmed these shows between the ages of 5 and 10. So I don't know what age I was when I first got my hands on this, but I took that home and I played it religiously. And I remember I was so upset when I had to give it back. Because, yeah, it was like a thing that you had to then give back to the toy box afterwards. So I would do everything in my power next time there was a film shoot to be the goodest bean to earn that prize again so I could take it home and play some more. Then, of course, I got into the anime that was on TV all the time. I was obsessed. I loved it. And I think in more recent years, after probably falling off the wagon for a little bit in favor of focusing on everything else that was going on in my life, whether or not that was chosen or not, I've come back to it in full force. So I love Japan, specifically Japanese popular culture, and I consume so much anime, but Pokemon is the biggest one, of course, and I collect so many Pokemon. For goodness sake, it is my favorite thing. It's the one thing that just is a little reward if I get some ADHD tasks done. I can maybe go and buy a Pokemon plush or a Pokemon blind box or something. That's sort of my reward for doing good,
Well, that's another,
even now.
that's kind of a skill in itself. If you do well, if you tick some of your boxes that were really difficult, go get yourself a little present.
Little treat. It's come full circle because if I did well on set, I got Pokemon, and now as an adult, if I do well and hit my goals, I get Pokemon.
It sounds like a lot of fun. If any of our listeners would like to check out Pokalesque, where can they see the show and get tickets? When's it showing?
So we're doing a full week season at Theatreworks in St Kilda. So 24th is the opening, and it's on the 24th, the 25th, 26th, 27th, and 28th of February.
Fantastic. And where are tickets sold?
So you can get them on Eventbrite or through the Theatreworks website.
And are there any websites people can check out to have a look at some of the, because I've had a look at some of the promo shots and they look like a lot of fun. And yeah, where can other people go and check that out? Is there an Instagram?
The Instagram is our main hub for sharing all of our behind the scenes, all of our interviews with cast and photos from our debut season in 24. So we've got lots of stuff up on our Instagram, which is just at Pokalesque. So it's Pokelesque. Q-U-E. Pokalesque.
Awesome. It was fantastic to have you on today, Rosie, and I hope some of our listeners might go and check out the show.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us at Brainwaves tonight. You can find more of our shows on the 3CR website, which is 3cr.org.au, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to send us feedback or suggestions for shows via email at brainwaves@wellways.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next Wednesday at 5 p.m. for another episode of Brainwaves on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.